Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Now, I thought I'd do a bit of a live stream, chaps, because I've come to the conclusion that these events are of today, of the 2nd of October, of Yom Kippur, of the Day of Atonement, are not insignificant. And one of the things that in the discussion that I've had, good evening, David Jordan. Oh, I haven't done the cheers. I'll do that in a minute. But one of the things that I, I blame the far right. Exactly. Precisely. Are not insignificant. I've had this debate ongoing. Good evening, Cassandra, with my friend Nima Parvini, with Academic Agent, on the idea of whether this is a civil war. And looking into it, we found that there is no clear definition of a civil war. And certainly the idea that a civil war involves the government versus an insurgent government does not seem to be how... yes, you're right, Carlotta. That is true. They have said that it's far right. I'll look at that in a minute. A civil war is that it's not actually to do with insurgent governments necessarily. You can have a low-level civil war, which is just a high level of violent conflict in the society. And you saw this in Northern Ireland, where in the 80s, for example, basically every week, if not every day, there was something. There was some kind of sectarian murder, and just all the time. In certain parts of the country, in certain more dangerous parts of the country where there was territory was contested and where the Protestants and the Catholics were more kind of side by side. For most of the areas were just either Catholic or either Protestant. You really didn't get that much, except occasionally you might get IRA might go to a pub in a very Protestant area and open fire, and then the UVF or whatever might do the opposite in a kind of tit-for-tat series of killings. But otherwise, you didn't get things like that. And what we've seen, what you would expect... Do I enjoy cigars, Michael Smith? Occasionally. So what you would expect to happen, chaps, is that as this civil war... Civil wars never just happen overnight. As these... they're gradual, and you look back and you realise that's what you're in. As this civil war ramps up, there will just be more and more and more violence. More and more events like this, they will become more and more and more frequent. And I think that you can easily tie this in with what happened to Charlie Kirk. What happened to Charlie Kirk is basically an emissary of the left, a leftist. I mean, you know, clearly we know what this person was like. We know his background was conservative and was Mormon, fine, but he was a leftist and he had all of the woke stuff going on, and this person assassinated Charlie Kirk, and it's just shocked the globe. And now what we have very clearly coming up to the anniversary of the massacre in Israel on October the 7th, and of course it's very noteworthy that it's on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the holy day of Judaism, the Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur, where traditional Jews are not supposed to work and they are supposed to fast, the 10th day of Tishrei, or whatever it's called. You have this guy who, come on, I don't think there's any doubt about it, is a chubby Muslim bald bloke, possibly putting explosives on himself from what we can see, but being thwarted and in the process killing two people, either with a knife in one case or using a car in the other case. And of course, this is connected in that, well, why are these connected to the political divide, the thing that killed Charlie Kirk? Because these people have been brought into the country by the left. These people are part of the coalition of the left. These people are here because the left want them to be here. They cannot be properly criticized and robustly examined and put under scrutiny because the left then passed laws against this. His very presence in Manchester is the fault of the left. They have blood on their hands with regard to what has happened today. It is their fault. They are the people that have passed laws stopping us from criticizing Islam and so on. They are the people that have introduced particularly in the UK, a situation where you don't feel you can say your opinion, because if you say your opinion, hello, French toast, there may well be a knock at the door from two young female police officers who are unarmed. They are the ones that are literally jailing people for hurty words said in the heat of the moment on Twitter. They are the ones that are bringing about a situation where you can't say what you want, where you can't express your opinion. And this galvanizes, of course, extremist Muslims who feel that they are essentially above the law. They won't be prosecuted for saying inciting things. They won't be held to account, and they can basically do what they like. And the entire system of multiculturalism exists in order to assist them and promote their interests. And you saw this in the UK during the Southport riots, where the English rioters were clamped down on, the English rioters were arrested, the English rioters were branded far-right thugs. That these two shut-up terms, far-right, what does far-right mean? How do you define far-right? Isn't it a highly emotive and elastic word that is used to shut up those with whom you happen to disagree? Isn't it used to shut down debate? It's just an insult. It's a means of shutting people down, a means of frightening people into not deviating from the path of orthodoxy, into reproving them for even thinking about doing so, such that frightened people don't do so. That is the purpose of the word far right. It is not a neutral term of analysis. It means, yes, it means something. Someone says it means fuck all. You can argue that it means something. You can argue that it has some meaning in relation to centre-right, but the problem is that it's become so emotional that the extent to which it's therefore a neutral term of analysis has very much been lost. So, yes, only whites are ever considered far. Indeed so. And so, someone was saying on the BBC today, I go back to what Carlotta was saying in the chat, Jewish people in the UK, they feel threatened by Islamic fundamentalism or pro-Palestine groups or whatever it happens to be, but also to some extent by some groups within the far right. Though the interview said that, well, the far right's attitude is rather ambiguous towards Jewish people. Obviously, people like Tommy Robinson and so forth are very much pro-Jewish. And it said, but there's certain neo-Nazis that they have to be scared of. And I thought to myself, well, hang on, that's complete nonsense. Name me these neo-Nazi groups in the UK that are advocating doing that to what has happened today to Jewish people. Name me these neo-Nazi groups in the UK that have done things like that, at least in recent years, in the last 80 years, to Jewish people. That's complete nonsense. They have absolutely nothing to fear from the right in the UK. The right has moved on from that. Very much so. They have nothing to fear from the far right. It is complete nonsense to try and associate this in any way with the far right. This is clearly a fundamentalist Muslim who has done this, and he has done this quite deliberately on Yom Kippur, in order to send a message. This is your holiest day, and we will do this on your holiest day. And it is the day as well in which it is the most religious Jews that are going to be observing this. Jews that aren't particularly religious probably don't fast today. Jews that are not particularly religious probably don't not go to work today. It is only the most religious Jews that are going to do that. And so it's quite deliberate. And then if you look at which synagogue has been targeted as well in Manchester, so we have at 9:31 that the police's attention was drawn to this. It is a synagogue in Middleton Road, which is in the Crump Hall area of Manchester. So this area of Manchester, by the way, is 69% Muslim, and it is next to another area of Manchester, which is about 56% Jewish. So that's exactly in a civil war. A civil war is on the borderlines. The incidents take place in low-level civil wars in contested areas. And that is what this area is. It's a contested area on the border between an area that is about 70% Muslim and an area that is about 60% Jewish. So it's on that contested area. This is exactly where in low-level civil wars, just like in Northern Ireland, this is exactly where these things can be expected to happen. And we have two dead and three injured. And also now it's been shown that the killer was shot dead. He is now dead. And this was at the Heaton Park Hebrew Congregational Synagogue. And if you look into the Heaton Park Hebrew Congregational Synagogue, which is in North Manchester, then this is an Orthodox synagogue. So I imagine that's entirely relevant that he targeted an Orthodox synagogue, because it would be Orthodox Jews, i.e. the more religious Jews, who would be going to the synagogue today on Yom Kippur. Had he targeted a Reformed synagogue, to be fair, my understanding, somebody mentioned in the chat Gateshead. Gateshead has a large Jewish minority, significant Jewish minority. And my understanding is that the non-Orthodox synagogues, the Reformed synagogues, are just closing down because the people that go to the Reformed synagogues are liberal and therefore they don't have many children. And there is a very strong degree to which the ones that are liberal will marry out anyway, and so the children don't end up being Jewish. And so even if they do end up being Jewish, they're very liberal Jews and they don't attend the synagogue and they don't really bother. So it's the Orthodox synagogues that are the only ones that are growing, and it's the Orthodox synagogues where people therefore are going to go on Yom Kippur. Sylph Wave says he lives in Gateshead and can confirm. Thank you. So it's the Orthodox synagogues that are going to be attacked. And that's, of course, what he's done. It's ironic, really, because there's a strong degree to which people that are Orthodox are not Zionists. Presumably it's Zionism in particular that Israel's what they see as Zionism that these people object to. But Orthodox Jews are not Zionists. So Orthodox Jews are the opposite of that. As my understanding is, the strictest Orthodox Jews take the view that Israel can only return at the end of time. And thus there is something kind of almost blasphemous about setting up Israel at all. And while they might go to Israel, they don't really kind of think it should exist until the end of time. So it's, in that sense, it's rather odd to attack what would be a non-Zionist synagogue. But anyway, I imagine the nuances of the different subgroups within Judaism is rather lost on a fundamentalist Muslim who engages. Hasidis are not Orthodox. Is that right? Anyway, the Orthodox are still against this kind of stuff. But I thought the Hasidis were a subgroup of Orthodox. I'm going to check that. I'm perfectly happy to be corrected in this sort of thing. Haredi. I didn't say Hasidi. Let me just check this. Important to get things right. Hasidic Jews are a branch of the ultra-Orthodox Church. So they are Orthodox. They're ultra-Orthodox. They're extremely Orthodox. Not all Orthodox Jews are Hasidic. So they're a subgroup of the Orthodox Church. Okay, so that's that. And then let's just check Haredi, a branch of Orthodox Judaism. Yes, so I was right, as is often the case. It's just the Hasidi and the Haredi are branches of it. So Haredi is a branch of Orthodox Judaism, are very strict as well. So Haredi, Hasidi, they're seemingly the same thing. They are ultra Orthodox. They are extreme Orthodox, so I was correct. Good. So a synagogue, not church, yes. But anyway, subgroups within it, and that's what we see. Now, I emphasise that one of the things that is interesting about this is, can you imagine the how mad they would go if this was a European who an English person who had attacked a mosque. And the result was two deaths and they had to shoot him. They would be going crazy. They would be saying, oh, this is terrible. This is the fault of the far right. this is the far right. They would associate it with Tommy Robinson. They would associate it with Nigel Farage. They would make hay with it. There would be every they would try to clamp down on their political opponents. They would go on and on about it, and they would use it as an excuse probably to bring in all kinds of draconian laws. But it's interesting that when it happens with an Islamist, they almost don't seem shocked. They don't seem shocked by this. They don't seem surprised by this. No one seems to be in shock. It seems to be almost expected. And if it's expected, then the question, if people's attitude is stoical, it's, oh, it's bound to happen eventually. Well, why? Why is it bound to happen eventually? And also, I think we should legitimately go on and on and on about the fact that this is these people would not be emboldened were it not for Labour. They would not be emboldened were it not for the left. They would not be emboldened were it not for Palestine marches. Even today, it was reported on the Isle of Skye that a local shop on the Isle of, like a little whatever, a mini Tesco or something, on the Isle of Skye had just suddenly shut down because the members of staff there wanted to protest for Palestine. And they put a thing in the window on the Isle of Skye stating that they were shutting the shop out of solidarity with Palestine. But yeah, with reference to what Carlotta is saying, the fundamental issue is diversity of any significant degree will lead to ethnic conflict. And the study by Tatu Vandenen, Ethnic Conflicts, found that about two-thirds of the variance in why different societies have different levels of ethnic conflict is simply ethnic diversity. If you don't have, if you have ethnic diversity, you will have ethnic conflict. And the Jews have been, and the more different ethnic groups you have, the more ethnic conflict you have, and the smaller is the majority group, then the more ethnic conflict you have. So ethnic diversity means ethnic conflict. It means different genetic cleavages that have different ethnic genetic interests, and it means them likely coming into conflict and them fighting each other. And what we are seeing on the streets of Heaton Park, on the streets of this area of Manchester, is an ethnic conflict which goes back a very long time in the Middle East being expressed in Manchester. And Jews have been in this country since Cromwell let them back in. They have been emancipated since, what, the 1829 or something like that. And there have been, you can go, whatever, you can discuss Kevin McDonald, what there hasn't been that much conflict, except for a very occasional anti-Semitic riots. And then, of course, the conflict in the 30s, which was brought on really just by Sir Oswald Mosley, just imitating, I think he was getting money from the Nazis. He had no interest in Jewish people. And he was getting money from the Nazis. And I am in Finland. Yes, why are you telling me this? Getting money from the Nazis, and then that was it. And so he ramped up anti-Semitism, and so you can completely see how this is the fault of leftist policy. This is the fault of large numbers of immigrants from certain parts of the world being in the country, and that is the fault of leftist policy. They're not. I don't think you could even, in a sense, start blaming immigrants. If you were in their position, you probably want to come to the UK. That's not the issue. The issue is, as they were saying on the Lotus Eaters today, the issue is a government that does not govern in the interests of the English or the British people. They're not there to govern in the interests of the British people. They're there to govern in the interests of certain client groups that assist them in gaining power over the rest of us. And as I imagine that everybody is familiar with this, with that heat, whatever you call it, not graph, that heat thing, where you see the leftist brain and the rightist brain. And the rightist's moral circle is a series of concentric circle, a heat map, that's the one. Thank you, Juan May 555. Someone's saying that anyway, and you see this heat map, and you see that that it emanates out from self, and the more it emanates out from self, the more genetically distant is the person. So in terms of the moral circle, and that's the conservative. And with the liberal, with the leftist, of course, that's not the case. The heat map is further out from self. And the reason for that is that they identify with people with marginalized people that are genetically distant from them. And this is very devious, and it allows you to collaborate with an outgroup while seeming like you're not collaborating with them, seeming like you just care about them because they're poor and marginalized and whatever. But in fact, you are collaborating with them in order to gain power over your own in-group. So it's a covert strategy. And it's a treasonous strategy. And it is the strategy we have always seen. And when I was a child, it was upper class people that had been to public school and posh universities collaborating with the working class, whom they pretended to care about. So people like Harold Wilson, well, he was liminal class himself, but people like Michael Foot and whatever, who'd been to public school and Oxbridge or whatever, been to university, and those kinds of people, the upper class, or Tony Benn's father, Viscount Stansgate, and indeed Tony Benn himself, those kinds of people. And it is a way of covertly playing for status while appearing nice. But when it comes down to it, they're always hypocrites. And in the case of Tony Benn, for example, he ended up being a very wealthy man, and he made all kinds of arrangements to avoid paying inheritance, to avoid his granddaughter or whatever having to pay inheritance tax, to just help out the people that were genetically close to him, when he could have helped out the people that were poor or whatever. He didn't truly care about those people when it came down to it. Like all left-wing people, nasty hypocrite. So it is their fault. This should be absolutely clear that the Labour Party, that the left has blood on their hands today. I did want to get some people's thoughts on what has happened, but I can't work out how to. Oh, that's it. Yes, I'm particularly interested on your thoughts on what has happened, by the way, if you are Jewish and living in the UK, and surely that you are living in the UK, because if I'm kind of, as you know, I live in Finland, and some unpleasant person said on Twitter today that I live in a castle in Finland, i.e. that I have no contact with the UK, but I do. I mean, I keep in touch with what's going on in the UK, and I come over now quite frequently. Indeed, I shall be over next week. So it is my country. So if you are in the UK, or particularly if you are in Matt, I just put the studio link in the chat. So if you are in the UK, and in particular if you're Jewish, I would be interested, because I've seen it with my own eyes. I was in, I forget where it was, it was a sort of Jewish area of London a couple of years ago, a year ago or so. Do you speak any Finnish? Yo, before them saw me, yo. Dr. Kai, but not then all that saw me, sir. Kaxkumin Devorta. Anyway, the point is that I was in an area of London. It was some area of London where there was a lot of Jewish people. This was about March. It might have been March 24, or was it May 24? I forget which. And I was being interviewed by Andrew Gold, who, of course, has a channel, Heretics, and is Jewish. It might have, was it Golders Green? It was somewhere around there. It was somewhere North London, somewhere like that. I don't know where. Stamford Hill. I can't remember, but it was somewhere around there. Anyway, there's a lot of Orthodox Jewish people walking about, and we went for some reason to find somewhere that an Uber could pick us up from. Me and my secretary went to the car park of a branch of Wicks, and there were these two Orthodox Jewish chaps minding their own business. Getting some supplies from Wicks, in order to do DIY. And the security guard was Muslim of the Wicks. And then there was these Muslim chaps in the car park. And they went up to them and just started asking them questions about October the 7th and what Israel is doing. And yeah, come on. The person's just messaged me. Come on. The link is in the chat. I'll send it. I'll put it to you here. So it was basically very intimidating. And I was waiting, frankly, for the security guard to intervene. I thought, well, surely the security guard is going to go over and say, hey, so you can see that this is unwelcome attention, that these guys don't like this, they don't want this. It's quite unpleasant, and the people are being quite unpleasant to them. But no, he just, of course, why would he intervene? And so I contemplated intervening myself, but then they just sort of stopped and went away. But it's obviously got quite bad. But it's got quite bad because you have these two groups that are in ethnic conflict. Right, someone's chimed in.
Good evening. Good evening, Ed.
Hello. Hi, how are you doing?
I am good. I'm excited to be on this show. I'm excited to talk to you again, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think I have some things to say. I would like to specify to the audience, I am not Jewish. I have some Jewish friends, and they offer some interesting insights. I have a very right-wing Jewish friend, and he has told me he is concerned on the rise of anti-Semitism in some way, another one as well. I would just like to give my thoughts on what's going on for someone right on the ground. It seems to me like the October 7th attack was, in some ways, it pushed the conversation on the right further. You've made this point 100 times, but it is quite normal now to have sort of Douglas Murray types, classical liberal right-wing types, to sort of have the conversation about what is the future of Islam and Muslims in this country. You can see it every day. People are increasingly happy, but sort of right-wing people are very happy to talk to you about what their views are on demographic change. It's got so bad nowadays that it's sort of like an emperor has no clothes moment. If you're slightly right-wing, you sort of just say it. Do you get what I mean?
Yes, I suppose it's so in your face and so ridiculous. If you go back 20 years or so, it was a little bit there, but it's so in your face. And it's also exaggerated, as there was a report that came out about that today, exaggerated in television commercials. So yes. it's made to look even more extreme than it is. But certainly in sort of 70% of people in TV commercials are black or something like this, or they're represented.
I heard a stat once that roughly there's as many black people as there are Muslims, even though there are black Muslims obviously in this country. But you see much more black people in adverts, in commercials on TV than you do of Muslims, which is interesting, which must show insight into how the left think about their sort of hierarchy of people they care about. It seems black people are even more concerned about the left than Muslims.
I suppose they are in a sense more integrated, really, and so they don't necessarily dress differently or have a different religion.
Yes.
So it's more palatable if you're going to promote ethnic diversity to use black people than, in particular, Muslims.
It does seem. Me and my friends have talked about this a lot, and in this conversation, what's going to happen in this country 20 to 30 years if things aren't reversed? And I hope this isn't a digression, but we're talking about Islam and Muslims in the UK. I wonder if there's supposedly a wave of secularization going across the Middle East. Supposedly when Muslims come back from the West, from Europe back to the Middle East, they recognize that people aren't fasting. And do you think there is a wave of, do you think Muslims are soon going to secularize and become nice liberal members of the British society? Or do you think it's going to...
I think that even among Muslims, it is being a conservative that predicts breeding.
So, yes, that's a good point.
and this is true. I think I've got some data on like Saudi Arabia on this. Even there, there's subtle differences. So even there, so I think that they will become more conservative eventually for genetic reasons. It's just that there's environment in the Middle East. There's just environmental things now that are going to make people less religious. But under the surface in these countries, I think that's quite temporary.
Sorry, you can kick me off at any time if I'm taking up too much time.
No, it would be interesting if you could go into more detail about these Jewish friends of yours and what experiences they've actually had.
I have one friend whose father is Jewish. He himself is Catholic, and I know by his definition of Jewish, but obviously you're still tied to that quite a lot. And he told me that they have maybe a menorah, one of these sort of visibly Jewish things outside the house, and they take it down last few months. Things like that are sort of canaries in the coal mines. Also, I talked to this one Jewish girl and the reason she sort of tipped over to being right wing, and this might just be purely like ethnocentric self-interestedness, is after October 7th, she was horrified by how pro-Palestinian and sympathy for Hamas people were in the UK. I have another friend whose mother's mother is Jewish, and by technical laws, he's told a few things to me. I think he's told me that his family are concerned. So that's is what I heard. I hope that isn't too anecdotal, too lacking of evidence. But you get the impression, I've heard on, I think, Lotus Eaters, that sort of synagogues around Hampstead area in London are now emptying out. Jews are making increasingly moving back to Israel.
Right. Yeah. So there's a certain degree of fear.
Yes. I think Jews for 2,000 years have been in fear of being a conscious minority, being a visible minority. So I think this is always playing on their mind. And this is the most recent example.
Okay, I see. I'm about halfway. I'm going to be on for an hour tonight, so I'm about halfway through. So can I just say to the assembled, if you're new, please do subscribe. Subscribe to the Jolly Heretic on YouTube if you're watching on there. Follow me on Twitter if you're watching on there. And most importantly, subscribe to my Substack. That's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the base things, including not behind a paywall, the most base things that I can't put on here, where I do put things behind a paywall as well, and where, including films I make, interesting interviews, it's been interesting people, vlogs, blogs, and where if you like what I do, you can support with the cost of a pint of beer a month. And also, by the way, I think they've still got tickets, I will be speaking at the Traditional Britain Group Conference on the 11th of October, I think it is, in London. So come and see me there. Hello, Charlie Pepper. Hello, Slounger. And all that. So I'm just, this chap here is a chap I know, and he knows a bit what's going on the ground. But otherwise, I mean, where you are is not, I suppose it's a different part of the country from Manchester.
I'm in a nice, relatively white part of the north of England. I don't want to go into too much further detail, but I'm in Yorkshire, which is there's different worlds. So you can either be in a very white, nice, high trust society, or you can get the train and go through Bradford and Preston, things like that. So you can see the balkanization. Day by day, we had a huge flag things where I am. I'd like to say I went to Leeds today for a job interview. Hopefully that doesn't dox me. And you can feel the decline in the country. It's full of homeless people, lots of newcomers. Let's just say it's sort of very UK. There was a Palestine march. The government buildings has LGBT stuff on them. I was speaking to a bunch of left-wing people at a coffee shop afterwards, and they believed all the sort of left-wing talking points about Charlie Kirk. They were almost happy that Charlie Kirk died. It's quite worrying that you think that these people are, how do we get together with these people? How can we agree on such basics, like it's wrong for political assassinations? On the ground, everything just feels a lot worse. People are so happy to talk about it. It's now, you can now sort of frankly say there are too many immigrants coming in and maybe we should send a few back, which is a positive. But everything is pretty bad in this country right now.
Yes, I made the decision on the 1st of July 2005 to leave this country because I thought it was a horrible dictatorship under Blair, and I had an opportunity to leave, and I thought it's only going to get worse. And I've been very much vindicated in that decision 20 years later, but it's got worse than I could have imagined. And the one thing that really I would say about the UK, yeah, it's awful in so many ways, but at least it's reasonably cheap, apart from with housing. Yeah, but that's not true now. So when I came to Finland in 2005, a pint of beer was about double what it was in the UK. And it's now the same. And food was maybe 70% more than it was in the UK. And it's now kind of cheaper.
So when I'm just a bit hungry and need some food, I go to Sainsbury's and Tesco's where I live. I'm shocked by both the terrible selection of food and the pricing, how much it costs to get some beef or get some steak. It's terrible. I don't know how people do it, really. Again, to tell some story about it, I've recently finished in university. I've found employment, but it took me several months to get a low level position. Presumably the employment laws under Labour, the workers' rights of all that's been proven, have reduced employment numbers. There's not many prospects for young people in this country unless you're lucky, unless you get on a good grad scheme. Everything is sort of falling apart. It feels like how Peter Hitchens described the last few days of the Soviet Union.
You think so?
Yes, I think so. I think, maybe it isn't as extreme, but whenever I listen to his chapter in his book on religion, which is very good, he describes just the absolute decay, moral as well. And I sort of see it parallels here, just how small things like, but shoplifting itself is effectively decriminalised. How you see where I live, sort of just antisocial behaviour, sort of chav kids just running about. The younger generation are sort of, I feel old saying that, but are so clearly devoid of any society, any actual decent cultural input.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tragic. The people have been sold this nonsense of going and getting a degree and then getting a debt to get the degree, when most degrees are pointless and unnecessary anyway.
Sometimes I'm scared I made a mistake, but we'll see.
Oh, well, you probably did. Most would be just be the same as most people. I mean, I know people that have been to top universities that have been unemployed or semi-unemployed for years and have debt. It's crazy. The expectation that you had if you were like in 1990, when we finished university, people my age, in 2002, you couldn't move for jobs. Nobody had trouble getting a job. And the tuition fees were just like £1,000. Yeah, people saying learn to code. Exactly. There was that did work in those days. And the tuition fees were just a symbolic thing, although of course they were a slippery slope to what then happened. And there wasn't this sense of all these people that were entitled, thinking that they're part of the elite and getting angry that there's only a small number of elite.
Peter Turchin talks about that.
Yeah, Peter Turchin, and there was none of that, and it was surely a basic thing is that life should get better. Like my granddad would talk about, how much worse it was when he was a kid than now. So I shouldn't, in many respects, and I shouldn't be talking to someone that's about, what are you, about 20 years younger than me or something.
Yeah, hopefully.
About how much better it was.
That is obviously a visible sign of decline when you know your parents and even grandparents were better off than you. That is so much worse. The only... I met up with a sort of dissident guy when I spent a summer in Canada, and I spoke to one guy and he said, one thing you have to remember though for our generation, however fucked we are now, when the boomer generation die off, a lot of us will inherit property, but that's really the only light at the tunnel unless you leave the country.
Yeah, but then you'll inherit property in the context of warfare and collapse and decay and the inability to protect that property and the need to pay protection rackets to protect the property. And probably property prices collapsing because it's not an asset anymore, because it's so dangerous to have property, because you could get a bit burnt down. So when the boomer generation die, there will be a huge transfer of wealth. And people are resentful of that. But all those people did was make a good investment. in a context in which property was cheap, and it was cheap property. In those days, in the 70s, most of your money was spent on food. And food was expensive. And property was cheap. And that was what Finland, by the way, was like 10 years ago or so. Food was expensive, property was cheap.
Yeah, I went to Poland in the last winter, early spring, and it was just a different world of how nice it was, how high trust it was, how cultured the whole thing was. It seemed like more of a real country than the UK, which almost feels astroturfed. And I have quite a lot of Polish friends, and I sort of tell them, like, if I were you, I would leave. I have nowhere to go to. It seems terrible, really. The only bad thing about going to Poland is when I immediately got off, when I went to Heathrow Airport, you just were immediately surrounded by sort of recent immigrants, Indians who could really speak English, and they're handling your passport, and you're going to things like that. It was pretty depressing.
That is extraordinary that should be the case. Yes, I'm going to Poland briefly soon.
And, where are you going?
Just to the airport to get a flight somewhere else. To Moldova, it's very interesting. Although I can't comment on Poland, but I can comment on Latvia, which is that when I was working there in 2012, it was poor enough that people still did things like, not only did they do gardening, I think about that. So people gave you got a council house, it had a garden, so you could grow vegetables, because that's how expensive food was in relation to income. That people would supplement their income by growing their own fruit and vegetables and having a greenhouse. And they didn't do that just because it was a hobby. They did that because you had to do that because food was so expensive. And in places like Latvia in 2012, people still did things like that.
From my own experience, I'm always embarrassed to say this, but I worked a lot in supermarkets and retail. And I was not even just shocked, but horrified by the amount of people buying like ready meals and things like that, which I just had no idea how they buy. But then you realize this is what a lot of people in this country eat. Polish guy said to me, his friend from the continent would tell him, we're horrified by how you Brits eat. Not just that you don't eat at a table, but what you physically eat is just absolute rubbish. Again, it's another symptom. It's another visible symptom of decline, which is everywhere.
I suppose eating at a table, I don't know, maybe some people with the family jobs don't allow it, I don't know, but the point that they eat takeaway food all the time, not only is very expensive, and then when it gets too expensive, then they don't know what to do, they don't know how to cook. That is not, gardening has not been passed on. That is a skill that has basically been lost for most people. Which a lot of people used to know how to do that, and now it's going to be cooking. Cooking is not passed on, and a lot of people don't know how to cook. And I personally, I was forced to learn to cook at university. I was compelled to, I was at university in the Netherlands, and there wasn't the same kind of takeaway culture that there was in England and the UK. So I just had to learn to cook, nor in Finland. But yeah, it's got pretty awful. Somebody mentioned in the comments, Matt Jackson, thank you for my advice to go to Albania. It was great. Yeah, well, I would want to live there. I mean, it's very poor. But as a holiday destination, it's not got touristy yet. And so it's worth going to Albania.
How many years time will we know we're in a civil war? Because obviously most people don't think we're in anything right now. Well, most people are sort of oblivious. 5 years, 10 years?
Well, even in Northern Ireland, I think it's retrospective, isn't it? So in Northern Ireland, when it was happening, when it was actually happening, they were in the 80s and 90s, they talked about the Troubles.
Mm.
And only retrospectively have they thought about it and realised it's a civil war. Not least because from a political perspective, it's not particularly good politics to admit that you don't really control an area of your country and that it's in a civil war. So they would just talk this euphemism, the Troubles.
Northern Ireland was not my friends. We were talking about this, what's going to happen, presumably going to happen. He's obviously one of our people. And he said, you know, Northern Ireland before 1968, 1969 was one of the safest countries or regions or whatever. in the entire world. They didn't record a single murder for 3 years, and that sort of shocked me by what can happen. The same thing of Lebanon. If you look at videos of Lebanon, perfectly nice, advanced Arabic country, and then in a few years' time, it's destroyed by sectarian violence.
Because they had large-scale immigration from a slightly different, and only very slightly different, ethnic group. And with Northern Ireland, it's interesting that there was undercurrents of tension. And of course, the Catholics were having more children than the Protestants. This led to further problems.
But the Monty Python skit.
Yeah, the Monty Python skit. Yeah, except Irish, and then you had they were basically galvanized by what was happening in America, and they identified with the African Americans. They thought, well, we're like them, and they've got civil rights, and so we can play for civil rights. And then of course you had a counter reaction, and then off it went. That was in the 60s. But until then, it was a very, very safe country. And now it is it's a very, very safe country, really. The tension between the communities has kind of gone substantially. So it's quite a good place to be. Of course, they're trying to change this. The woke people in Northern Ireland are trying their best to destroy it as comprehensively as they can. So it hasn't got long. If anyone else, by the way, would like to, I'll put the thing in the chat again. And if anyone else would like to pop in, that would be very interesting. As I say, I'm particularly looking for anybody who is Jewish in the UK, perhaps, who has experienced the consequences of October the 7th and of the degree to which, as far as I can see, these Palestine activists just get a free pass. To do whatever they like, So it's not looking good on the ground. So what do you have friends of your age that just thinking of just getting the hell out, or are they just despondently resigned?
Yes and no. I'm thinking about getting the hell out. I don't really have much of an idea, but I'm thinking about applying for jobs in Central Europe or even in Middle East or Far East. But it's a very normal thing nowadays for people to finish university, not to have a fucking clue what they're doing, and to at least travel to Southeast Asia for 3 months and to sort of find themselves. If I think about friends who want to get the hell out of the people I know, I'm friends of quite a lot of right-wing people who are sort of like, fuck that. No, I wouldn't want to do that, not to use foul language. Surprisingly not, even though it's about 1 in 5 young people want to leave the country, really seriously think about leaving the country. I personally don't know myself, but their responses would be the country's going to die and I'm going to die with it or something like that. But I am thinking about it too, because I had an American friend who did a master's at my university, let's just say, and he would constantly speak to me about how much worse we are than the US, how much less money we make. It would shock me that he can make 60, 70, 80, 100 grand in a year, which just seemed alien to me. I don't know that many people who wish to leave.
Yeah, they have higher salaries, but they have to pay for things like private health insurance. And
it's a horrible country. I don't like it.
I don't know. Well, I just don't like, I just can't deal with tipping. I hate it. I hate it so much.
It's your show. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I spent the summer there. I enjoyed my time there, but it seems it's a mad country. I was 5 hours away, which is in their distance, close to where Donald Trump was shot. I was in Pennsylvania at the time. But it just seemed everything was so on-edged. Everything also just in general feels fake. You have to drive everywhere. The only good places are on the East Coast. And I couldn't. The tipping culture is mad as well. And things are quite expensive at the same time. But it probably was the safe parts of the US are much safer than most parts of the UK.
Yes, that's the impression I get being there. I mean, I went to Detroit, and I don't remember going into a single shop where there wasn't a sort of gun-proof screen covering where you pay and a sort of a revolving thing that you put the money in.
Detroit was one of the richest. Well, wasn't it an industrial center in the 60s and 70s? But it got completely ripped out by free trade. And obviously, we're talking about how easily a country or a region or whatever can change, and then suddenly it's now a ghetto. I mean, I got the train through Newark, which is just by New York, and I was horrified by what I saw. I wanted the train to leave immediately. I thought I was going to get robbed. But some parts of America are awful.
There was serious race riots in Detroit, and after that there was massive flight from it. Someone's saying Motor City. Yeah, there's that. Well, also there's that factory. There's that factory there that's just been left in rack and ruin since the 50s, and you can see what that does. So it starts to fall down
Are you concerned? I've been thinking, especially after Rupert Lowe was kicked out of Reform, that things will just keep declining, and there will never be. This country will just. Permanently be terrible, and there won't be any right-wing backlash, because I know there are signs of positivity, but I am quite concerned that Reform will win in 2029, and I've decided I will not vote for them, and they will do simply nothing, or they might just extend Blairism to getting rid of the House of Lords.
I don't know. I think that the impression I get from talking to people, the conversations that one has, is that so many people think that it's so bad that it's almost like there's nothing to lose. Who cares? Who cares who you vote for? Who cares if people say this is a conservative Labour toss-up, so you shouldn't vote Reform, you'll split the vote. Just who cares? It might even make people, like the referendum, it might even make people vote who wouldn't normally vote, like the EU referendum. And then I suspect Reform will do quite well. He's playing this game where he doesn't want to seem too extreme or have any connections with anything too extreme, and presumably he will gradually change that later. So that's why he's literally fired people for advocating policies that he is now advocating, because he's a control freak and because he didn't want those things advocated at that point.
I heard, okay, this is very hearsay, but I heard back in 2022, I believe, from someone in the know that Nigel Farage is wildly more right wing than he lets on. But that has not yet been proven. I think it could be like a sort of 2016 Trump moment where people celebrate and then nothing really happens.
Well, that's the thing. He will be up against the blob in the same way that Trump was, and Trump didn't expect to be. I get the impression Trump didn't anticipate how there would be everything in his way to try and stop him doing anything. And so I think that Farage has to just come in and immediately, while he has a large majority, pass quite unbelievably extreme laws, such as a great repeal of all legislation passed since, let's say, the 2nd of May 1997. Simply everything is abolished, every single thing, except things they mark as not being abolished, that sort of thing. And it has to be done quickly, because you can only do these things when you have the momentum of getting into government. Then events take over. Look at COVID. Things happen and you sort of slow down. You can't get anything done. He has to immediately come in on day one and just abolish all legislation passed since the 2nd of May 1997. There needs to be mass firings in the civil service, a complete overturning. And preferably, I would like there to be, of course, a law that says that free speech is absolutely, it's a criminal offence to suggest there should be restrictions on free speech anywhere. Mm. But short of that, a total act of oblivion, like in the Restoration, and it has to be done quickly while the left are in shock and can't organise. Day one, march everybody into Parliament and abolish all legislation.
They are terrified of... I sound like such a child saying this, but I see it on my TikTok, and I see it also just talking to left-wing people. They are absolutely terrified by Reform. They think he's going to do all sorts of things, and I'm sort of like, I agree with you, I don't like Reform, but for different reasons. If you say you would vote for Reform to the wrong person, you will just get heckled, or worse, possibly. I having this sort of after-interview talk with these people, they live in a different world. They're terrified by Tommy Robinson. They're terrified by Nigel Farage, even though I think they're quite milquetoast. Well, the phrase would be quite moderate.
Yes, they are. They catastrophize and they make their enemies. They paint their enemies as more extreme than they are, and all this sort of thing. Yeah, but they. I think a lot of it is social signaling. Like, I don't think they are really that terrified, but they have to social signal that they're terrified in order to get what they want and in order to look good in front of their group. But in reality, he'll be probably far more moderate than they're making out he's going to be. But it has to be the first is it has to be done quickly. It has to be quickly done. That all this legislation on free speech that's been used against Lucy Connolly or whatever is abolished straight away on day one. No debate, no discussion. He's got a huge majority. Just push it through. Before anything can happen, because that was the problem with the Conservatives, with Boris, as I said, they got the thing done with Brexit. There were other things, then events took over. You've got to get it done quickly. Get out of the Human Rights Act, abolish the Supreme Court, anything since the 2nd of May 97. Well, that was the great treason. I would say that's a binary. Before the 2nd of May 97, the country was basically a free country. After the 2nd of May 97, it increasingly wasn't. And that should be the cutoff point, even for immigration. If you've come to this country after the 2nd of May 97, we should, on a case-by-case basis, look into whether you can stay. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. But thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to talk to a person at the coalface of modern Britain and who's going to be struggling through this new South Africa after I've gone. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, tally-ho. Goodbye. Right. That, I thought that was quite interesting. It was very interesting, actually. You get completely out of touch, I think, if you're older, as to just how bad it is for the younger generation. It should be better. It should be better for the idea that my parents' university was free, but my generation had to pay something, and his generation had to pay a lot, is the absolute reverse of what should be happening. It should be that it was free for my parents and they got a grant. So my generation should get a bigger grant, a better grant, not that the whole thing should be reversed. So this is a country that is going backwards, and in which there is no hope. What is the hope for the future? What is the feeling? What is there to be positive about? What is there to look forward to as a nation? How on earth can Keir Starmer say, oh, our best days aren't behind us? Of course our best days are behind us. If we had an empire and ran the world, and now we don't, then inherently our best days are behind us. How you can say our best days aren't behind us? What you can at least try and do, if you're not going to be an empire nation, is be kind of like Finland, though they're trying to wreck that, doing all they can to wreck that, and be a high trust society in which everything works and in which you can trust everybody and in which, you know, life is basically reasonably good. Now, you pay for that with things like taxes, high taxes, taxes on food, whatever. You pay for that. But at least when I came here, there was this sense that things were going well and that the future could be good. Now, part of why this feeling has gone could be to do with my friend Jani Miettinen's theory that we're just going through a situation where the younger generation are very high in dopamine, and this makes that generation, his generation, basically grumpy teenagers, and this spread, and because they're active and whatever, because they're young and they're, you know, physically active and moving about and aggressive and antisocial, things are pushed in the direction that represents them. And so the whole society becomes bellicose and tearing apart and whatever. And perhaps when we get to another generation that is more like, in terms of these hormone cycles that we go through across four generations, that is more like my generation, that is more like the generation born in the 60s or whatever, then this won't be the case. But the argument is that currently the generation that is the Generation Z are a similar psychology to the generation that was born in kind of the 20s. And that is the generation that basically, he argues, that by their behavior brought about massive war. and was highly conservative. And, you know, Billy Graham rallies and being even more anti-gay than was the case before and whatever else. And then the cycle then continues into a new and more laid back kind of generation. Gen X, like yourself here. Hello, Gen X, Larry Jim Bob person. And I am Gen X. I was born in 1980. When I was a kid, I was Gen X. That's what Gen X was. And by the way, a boomer was somebody born between about 1945 and 1950. Somebody born in the 50s was not a boomer. They were not a boomer. I don't know what they were. They didn't name the generations as much in those days. And you've got all this nonsense now of them retrospectively naming generations, the silent generation. What the hell is that? No, there was baby boomers, i.e. people that were after the war babies. And it may be that this baby boom went up into the 60s, but those people were not described as boomers. Absolutely not. Boomers, in the 80s, they talked about baby boomers. Not boomers, baby boomers. And what they were people born between about 1945. Guarantee the Jolly Heretic never went to a rave. Well, if by an illegal rave, is that what you mean? That it's an illegal gathering? Then no. Well, why would I do that? So, outrageous suggestion. X is 65 to 80. Not when I was a kid, it wasn't. When I was a kid, X was probably, 60, into the 80s. Certainly into the 80s. And then they created this idea of a millennial, and a millennial was born about 1990, something like that. And they started talking about millennials in about the year 2000. And then they decided to make a millennial older and older and older and older and older and older and older. Boomers are 79. Boomers are 79. Now they are. No. And older and older and older and older and older. And so I would call the police on a legal rave, yes, if I could hear it, because as far as I'm concerned, my home is my castle. And if you cause the atoms in my home to change in their activity or composition in any way, you are trespassing. And there should be complete silence in my house at all times, other than noise that I choose to make. And that should be absolute. There should be no question of me ever hearing anything. Music, a dog, an argument, I don't care. That should be a crime. It should be criminal trespass. It's totally, totally outrageous. I have a plutonium core in my home. No, I don't have. Anyway, if anyone else would like to come on, particularly, as I said, if they are in the UK and can give me more of an impression of what's on going on the ground, that would be jolly interesting. But otherwise, unless there are any questions, I might wrap up. So 15-year cycles. Sorry, what? No. It was 20-year cycles. It was 80 years. So it's the fourth turning, and the idea is that it's previously been, as a consequence of this, a massive collapse, a massive breakdown, a massive war, whatever, every 80 years. And this may have been delayed in this cycle because we are just so rich. We are so wealthy. We are so not up against it. And there may be other reasons as well. But it's delayed. It should have already happened, but it hasn't. It's been put off. It's been postponed by the wealth that we've managed to accrue. Thoughts on toast, Ed? I like my toast well toasted. In fact, my daughter got very upset the other day, on Friday. I had toasted a burger bap till it was severely toasted, as I like it. And then she did the same, and she was very angry because she likes her toast to be lightly toasted. So, no, I like my toast well toasted. Although, weirdly, when I was about 10 or 11, I liked my toast lightly toasted. So these kinds of things change with age. Like when I was young, I liked very mild curries, like chicken korma, that kind of thing. And then now I like very spicy curries. And when I go to the brilliant restaurant, the brilliant Nepalese restaurant in Oulu, then I have to ask them to spice it up. Although you have to be careful doing that, because sometimes they will kind of take the piss. And they will make it. I have no thoughts on encryption laws. It's not a thing. I haven't thought about them. I don't like my toast like charcoal banter. But I am losing taste buds, says Cafe Max. Yes, I may well be. I like things to be stronger than I used to. So anyway, I think this is just another. The fact that this has happened so relatively quickly after Charlie Kirk thing is consistent with this a movement in a general direction of breakdown. But we will see what happens. Okay, thank you, chaps. Tune in for the live stream on Monday. And obviously, as I say, if you haven't subscribe here on YouTube. It really helps to do that. And subscribe on my Substack, that's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most basic stuff I can't put here, and where if you support me, you can see all kinds of very basic stuff for the cost of £5 per month. Okay, I have no thoughts on Ukraine either. Okay, cheerio, chaps, tally-ho, and goodbye.